Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society.
Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Cornegus, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is a man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hello, Dawn. Great to be here today.
So our guests today are Drs. Arena and Michael Comboy of the Department of Bioengineering at the University of California, Berkeley. In their lab at Berkeley, the Comboys investigate the process of tissue repair in the body in an effort to determine why damaged tissues do not productively repair as the body ages. So in today's interview, you will hear the Comboys talk about their early research and a fascinating technique they pioneered called heterochronic parabiosis, where the couple took a young mouse and an older mouse and joined them together surgically. So the Comboys found that the older mouse benefited from this fusion, and its aged stem cells became rejuvenated and its muscle tissues became functionally stronger.
Since then, the Comboys' follow-up research has provided fascinating insights into stem cell niche engineering, tissue repair, and stem cell aging and rejuvenation.
And this remarkable research coming out of the Comboy lab has profound implications in terms of postponing the onset of age-related diseases, as well as the prevention of degenerative conditions such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, osteoporosis, and even sarcopenia.
But before we get to today's interview with Irina and Michael, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we are especially appreciative of all the wonderful five-star reviews.
As always, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the moniker Camaldo. The review is titled, How Much Do I Love Thee, STEM Talk? It reads, How much do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I know thee on the drive to work and sometimes on coffee breaks. My mind boggles when listening to the guests' scientific flights. I use thee to aspire towards a graduate degree program. I delight and smile freely staying up to date on current research and listening to Ken and Dawn ask great questions. If only a STEM Talk t-shirt will come my way, I can then ignite the name of STEM Talk to my friends.
Well, thank you, Camaldo, and thank you to all of our other STEM Talk listeners who've helped STEM Talk become such a great success.
Okay, and now on to today's interview with Drs. Irina and Michael Comboy.
STEM Talk.
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 Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Dawn Cornegus, and joining us today is Irina and Michael Comboy. Irina and Michael, welcome to STEM Talk.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, and also joining us is Ken Ford.
Hello, Dawn, and hello, Comboys.
Hello, Ken.
So let's start with you, Irina. You grew up in what used to be called the Soviet Union. I understand that you were a fairly passionate gymnast back then. Is that right?
Well, you cannot really tell that it's a passionate gymnast, but I was a gymnast, and it was high-impact gymnastics. So I was very serious about that. I started when I was six, when I was picked in my elementary school. And I continued doing gymnastics until I broke both of my arms and my parents told me to focus on my academics instead.
Well, that sounds like a good plan. So at what point did you become interested in science and what inspired you to study biology specifically?
Well, long time ago, again, when I was five or six, I noticed that I'm getting physically bigger and I tried to project what is going to happen next. So like when you cannot fit under the table anymore, what then happens next? And I realized that I will grow old and will be like my grandma. And I noticed how my grandma's skin looks so much different from mine. And I felt pity and I wanted to help her to basically live longer. And that's what precipitated my interest in biology and specifically in biology of aging.
So, Michael, I understand that growing up, you were a pretty nerdy kid who spent a lot of time outdoors studying bugs. Is that right?
That's a pretty accurate assessment. I used to like to, I wasn't really all that, I had friends, but I wasn't super social. I usually preferred to just sit out in the backyard and look at bugs. My family lived outside of Chicago for a couple of years, And one of those years was one of the 17-year locust years, 17-year cicadas. I remember the grubs just crawling out of the ground everywhere and pupating on the trees and the house and any place they could find. And then it was just swarming with cicadas. There were so many cicadas that I could find what in biology is a very, very unique event, the albinos. And I used to collect jars and jars of just the bleachy white bugs. Yeah.
Michael, you grew up in Massachusetts and attended Harvard. What were your plans when you started school? Where did you see yourself going?
Well, I entered as a pre-med and majored in biochemistry, which was sort of the shortest path to get all of my pre-med requirements out of the way as part of the major requirements. Yeah, I was going to be when I was little, I was going to be a brain surgeon, and then I realized that you could say neurosurgeon, and it sounded smarter. Smatter. Right? Yeah.
Was there something about the lab work or the environment that persuaded you to abandon medical school and focus more on research? What precipitated that change?
As part of the program, we had opportunities to go intern in labs and work in a lab to learn some basic research. And all of a sudden, I realized that was the place for me. I could go in the lab, and there might be, 10 other people in the lab there, and nobody would talk to you for an hour or two. You could just focus on your bench and do your science. And at about that time, I realized that's probably where I'd be happier. Medicine's a noble profession, but you gotta kind of like people, and you gotta put them at ease and have some good bedside manners. I'm not so sure if I had the patience to around people to cultivate good bedside manners. But in the lab, I could, I could spend hours in the lab, and I did spend hours in the lab.
And Irina, I understand that you have an interesting story about your first visit to Boston and how a female friend of yours has set you up with a lot of dates before you even set foot in the U.S. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that is the famous story of how our family started, really. I had this friend from high school when we were back in the Soviet Union, and her family immigrated to the United States in the very early 80s or late 70s. I don't really remember. So then the time came when, for the first time, Soviet Union citizens were really allowed to visit abroad. And she invited me to visit for a couple of weeks. And she was at the time at Harvard, where was my husband of over 25 years also, Mike. So she asked me to send my photograph to her, and I did. And then she apparently brought this photo to her lab because she was very busy as being first year student there. She was extremely busy, so she wanted to make my visit, my short visit, as interesting as possible. So she asked every single guy in the laboratory to take me out. She said, "This is my beautiful friend Irina. Can you take her out?" And then, so they basically said, okay. And she scribble in her notebook saying, okay, you will be Monday and you will go to movies, and you will be Tuesday and you will go to the zoo. And then Mike was Thursday. So Mike was Thursday and he took me out disco dancing. But the best part of the story is that she did not tell me that it was all arranged. So here I come to Harvard, and all of these single, strappy young lads are lining up to ask me out. And I'm like, what's going on? Yeah. Maybe the way I look, or I don't even speak English well enough. I spoke a little bit. And so they cannot really tell what a great person I am, but they're already asking me out. And so so maybe the way that I look is perfect for Harvard, and that's what is in style. So that's how Mike and I met, pretty much, and it was over 30 years ago.
Wow, that's a great story.
That's a great story. So Michael, can you tell the story about how you found yourself in Moscow asking Irina if she wanted to hang out?
Yeah, so that was, it was just coincidence. The Soviet Union was changing, right? They had Gorbachev and Perestroika and Glasnost, that kind of stuff. So my dad had seen changes in Japan. So he was in the Korean conflict for a few years and had seen the changes in Japan after the Second World War, basically, that period of time. And he predicted, he was passionate about going to the Soviet Union and seeing it before it changed and broke up and or did whatever it was going to be, before it became westernized, I guess. So he had arranged a trip for Moscow, Kiev, and Leningrad. It was like one of those package deals, and asked me if I wanted to go. And I said, yeah. And we had arranged this months before. I couldn't get into a to a Russian language class, but I could take a night class on reading Russian. So I learned all the letters. And then, you know, coincidentally, then I'm in the lab working one day and Irina's friend comes by with the notepad and the picture and, you know, I'm on Thursday, right? So then a couple months later, I was in Moscow and I had gotten Irina's number. I had told her that I might be visiting and can I get your number for when I'm in Moscow? So I gave her a call and so she we met up. She took us around and showed us some of the sites in Moscow. And then we sort of had this sort of like long distance relationship. I mean, it was like we'd write each other letters and send each other pictures.
For like 2 years or so.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sending cassette tapes of our favorite songs. That was like a big thing. We had, you know, back then we had cassette tapes, right?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. For some reason, I would always visit in winter and Irina would visit here in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So.
But you got the bad end of that deal, Michael.
Well, I like the winter. It's okay.
So, Michael, after you graduated from Harvard, you got a job as a lab technician at Harvard and then eventually joined a friend of yours from Harvard who was heading off to Philadelphia to start his own lab. So can you tell us about how you and Irina found yourselves as professional lab rats in Philadelphia?
Sure. So we started this lab in Thomas Jefferson University. The assistant professor, Brian, he brought me along. I was happy to go along because it was kind of interesting. Instead of doing one task or whatever or two couple tasks in the lab, it was basically Brian and me, right? So I had to do pretty much everything. Ordering supplies, you know, setting up microscopes, figuring out how to accomplish our research goals when we might not even have all the equipment, things like that. And we wanted to get a technician, and it took a very long time to get the paperwork and get through the bureaucracy. So it was, I think it was like the day before Irina was going to come to visit one of her trips in the summer, and the professor asks me, Does Irina know science? She studies science, and does she know molecular biology and things like that? And I said, yeah, I think so. So he said, tell her to bring her diploma, right? So I get on the phone and I call Irina. It was back then you had the you know touch tone phones and you had to dial like 10 times to get the call to go through. And I said, hey, Irina, bring your diploma. And she's like, what? Why do I need that? I said, just bring your diploma. So she brought it. And
I was hired as a technician.
And you were hired as a technician, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So
which was it was cool.
Yeah. So he there's two matchmakers in this story. There's one Irina's friend Jenya who set me up as Thursday, and then there's Brian who hired me
to work in the lab. Exactly.
Yeah, right.
But I want to add that even though we were like what you call lab rats, it was great first job for me because I did not do just some boring things.
Yeah.
We actually had an interesting project and I felt that this is amazing. So many opportunities that I have here, even if I'm like a simple technician. So that got me completely enthused with American science. His very first work as a very low position, like a technician, laboratory technician.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're helping to figure out, you're on a paper, helping to figure out how genes get turned on.
Yeah, that was amazing. We actually studied those little fruit flies. They're called fruit flies because they're tiny, tiny bugs that fly around fruit usually.
Everybody knows a fruit fly.
Everybody knows, right? So, so we studied their development and how genes are turned on. And at a particular time in a particular place. So that was amazing. That really got me completely involved in just science. And I wanted to go to the graduate school. I was working as a technician, but I started looking at the GRE tests. What can I do to actually advance now and to have PhD degree? So that was from that first job that I had.
Michael, I understand that you would probably still be a professional lab technician if it weren't for Irina, as we were just hearing. Irina wanted to study aging. Can you talk about how that led to your decision to pursue a doctorate and head off to the West Coast to Stanford?
Yeah, sure. I mean, what I really enjoy about science is doing the science in the lab. And sometimes as you progress through the ranks into professor, you end up spending a lot more time in your office and writing papers in front of the computer and that kind of thing. But people had been telling me for years, you know, oh, you should apply to graduate school. You should go off and be a scientist. You should go apply to graduate school, blah, blah, blah. So, but when Irina came, she had a concrete goal and idea. She wanted to study aging. She wanted to cure aging. She wanted to fight aging. So we said, okay, well, how do we do that? Right? Well, we didn't really know how to do that, but we realized that getting a PhD would give us the training to be able to answer that question, to be able to figure that problem out. My English was better, so I applied first. And I applied to a bunch of schools out in California, and got into Stanford, among a couple, and visited Stanford. And what impressed me about Stanford was that nobody paid me any attention. because they were all busy doing their science, and that seemed like the perfect place for me, right? So that's how we moved out to the West Coast and entered graduate school. And Irina can probably tell her side of the story about that later, how then she applied to graduate school and got in and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and Irina, you eventually also pursued a PhD at Stanford and studied autoimmunity in the laboratory of Patricia Jones. So how did that come about?
So Mike was already accepted to graduate school, and I really, really wanted to be in the graduate school. So I tag along because we were already married to his interviews to Stanford, UCSF. He basically was on the shortlist for most prestigious graduate programs. And so when I was sitting there and listening to him discussing things with the professor, it was actually kind of very upsetting to me because I was nowhere near PhD program. So very often when we go home, I even cried and said, oh, Misha is the Russian name for Mike. You are going to have such an interesting life, and I don't. So I started as hard as I could. And when Mike was at Stanford graduate school, I again worked as a technician in a laboratory that studied brain development in a very famous, very good laboratory. So then the laboratory professor advised me to ask other Stanford professors if I could take their classes, even though I am not an official student, if I could just audit and then get their letter of recommendation. And that was excellent advice. So I was basically, I had a feeling that I'm already at Stanford and I studied very hard, particularly in the Lubert Stryer class.
And if you don't know, if you're not a biochemist and you don't know Lubert Stryer, there's a biochemistry Bible. You know, he wrote one of the books.
He wrote one of the books. So yeah. I asked him, I said, I basically said, Lubert, and I spoke still, you know, I spoke much better English because it was already a year and a half. But still, you know, I said, Lubert, can I take your class just as a yardstick to measure my Russian grades from Soviet Union and see how do I do in American school? Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, you can audit my class and you can come to my office hours, even though I was just a technician, which again was just amazing notion for me coming from Soviet Union. So then I took his class, I audited it, and I even took exam and he even graded it. And of course, it was nowhere on my transcript because I was not a graduate student. He then was able to write me a very good letter of recommendation saying that, dear colleagues, please accept Irina to your program without any hesitation and feel free to get in touch with me if you need amplification of the above. And of course, the laboratory where I worked as a technician also provided me a good letter. And so to make this story short, only later I found out that usually American students apply to 10 or more schools to get into any graduate program. But my husband was already at Stanford, and so I applied only to Stanford to do my PhD. And I was accepted to 2 out of 3 programs, which was a good deal. So for the low price of, I forgot how much it was, like $70, you can submit 3 applications to different 3 programs at Stanford, which was a big consideration back then for us. And so that's how I got into Stanford Biological Science Department. And after doing a rotation, one in the fruit fly lab and one in the immunology lab, I decided to join Pat Jones's laboratory, which was great decision. So it was one of the best decisions of my scientific life was to do my PhD in her lab. It was outstanding, superb laboratory.
Fantastic. And while doing your postdoc work with Tom Rando at Stanford, you wanted to understand what caused muscle stem cells or satellite cells to age and lose their capacity for repair and generation of muscle tissues. In your 2003 paper in Science magazine, you reported that old stem cells could be reactivated and actually made to behave like young ones if they're appropriately stimulated. So can you talk a little bit about your discovery that notch signaling had the potential to regenerate aged muscle, and maybe take a step back first and also briefly explain notch signaling for our listeners?
So that actually takes me one step back to my Stanford education, because when I was studying at Stanford, I realized that embryonic development of various organs, muscle, eyes, brain, liver, is all controlled by pretty much the same canonical biochemical signals. And we call it signal transduction pathways. So very interestingly, regardless of what specific part of your body you are building, it will be interplay between very similar signal transduction pathways. And when I started my postdoc in Tom's lab, I had this hypothesis or idea that the same thing happens when our organs are being repaired. So whatever molecules build our organs will be again at play when we damage our organs and they have to regenerate. So that was my idea. And knowledge pathway is one of those key evolutionarily conserved molecules. So it operates during embryonic development when we have to construct our bodies. And then what we discovered a year before that 2003 paper is that knowledge pathway also works when our muscle is damaged and is being regenerated, which happens throughout our life. For example, if you go to the gym. And of course, after that, the next logical question was, what happens when we grow old? Because we know that when you grow old, there is lots of pain and still no gain, right? As compared to when you are young, there is no pain, no gain. So then when we looked in more detail, we realized that this notch pathway is perhaps the culprit because it is now not activated. When mice are getting old, they damage their muscle, which we can do experimentally. But the activation of this key pathway by which cells signal to each other is lacking. And so then the next logical step was to see, can we rejuvenate the muscle if we experimentally trigger notch pathway? And the answer was yes. Then the old muscle repaired just fine. And so that had many implications. One, it implicated key biochemical signaling in repair of the skeletal muscle and also in aging of the skeletal muscle. And secondly, it showed that with very small and rapid changes, which are could be done experimentally or perhaps medically, you can make old tissue young in a very short time frame.
Irina, you finished your postdoc work before Michael did and found a position at Berkeley. This was a great move for you, but the move ended up putting, I imagine, a little tension between the two of you because you are working now in sort of competing labs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So that probably is common not just to us, but to many postdocs. Because when you are doing postdoc is when you are very well trained. You already have your advanced degree. You are discovering something which is at the cutting edge of science. And so then official expectation is that you take that what you discovered and you start your own laboratory. So it's almost like if you have a beehive and you have swarming bees with the new queen which flies away and sets up another beehive. So that is the metaphor. But unfortunately, if you discover something great, as Mike and I did with Tom Rando when we were all postdocs in his lab, then there is also expectation that his laboratory, your original beehive, will continue to work on the same science. And so it is really nobody's fault. It's just the nature of things is that then there is a competition between your lab where you were working as a postdoc and the new lab that you are starting and spinning off that. But because Mike was still with Tom, then it became really, really tough for us because we didn't know, like, we love discussing science. And now we didn't know, is it a conflict of interest or what can we discuss? Who had this particular idea? Does it belong to Kanboy Laboratory or does it belong to Rando Laboratory? And so all of a sudden we started arguing almost daily. And maybe Misha will add up on that.
If you read stories, historical accounts or whatever of, let's say Watson and Crick, right? Discovery of DNA and science that as it went on in the last century, you get the feeling of a strong connection between the professors and then the PhD students or the postdocs who then go on to do their own science in their own lab. Often that connection and collaboration is maintained. It's unfortunate that the perception seems to have changed, and my guess is that it probably has to do with the levels of funding that where professors are writing grants and getting maybe only 10% of their grants funded. That puts a lot more competition between everybody, including professors and their postdocs. So that's kind of an aside story. Since we've worked together at Berkeley and have our own lab, we now are not competing with Tom Rando's lab, and the interaction is a lot more cooperative and collegial. Which is the way it should be.
Exactly. Right? It was always collegial.
Tom's a great scientist. Yeah. He has a great lab there and is a great mentor.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And it was always collegial interactions, but it became very, very tricky scientific waters to navigate when we were just developing our scientific direction and Mike was still in Tom's lab.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So, Irina, you had the insight that if it was possible to boost the regenerative capacity of stem cells, that it could maybe delay or even reverse the onset of aging. And a lot of good science begins this way, with an idea or an observation that leads to a question or a really good question. But for you, Irina, I understand it was more about trying to understand the pieces of a puzzle that led you to look into reactivating old stem cells. Can you talk about this process?
Yes. So, Basically, it takes me back to the science paper, and then we are going probably to discuss later on our Nature paper, which people, I think, misinterpreted as aging could be easily reversed, and all we need to do is one specific silver bullet. For example, we need to add molecule X to old people, or we need to kill their senescent cells. In my opinion, any one specific thing is not going to do it, because aging is really multigenetic and multifactorial. And if it was one thing, then certainly there would be organisms where this one thing would be just naturally mutated, and there will be plentiful immortal organisms. But those do not exist. However, if it is a puzzle and there are many pieces, and you need simultaneously change numerous things, then it's very difficult to evolve out of aging naturally. However, experimentally, you can understand what are those pieces and put them together. And that would be the way to reverse, attenuate, and prevent aging process. Not forever, of course, but for a few healthy decades that you add to people's quality of life.
Michael, I understand that you were the one who came up with the idea of the parabiosis experiment, in which the skins of two mice, one young and one old, were essentially sutured together. However did you come up with that?
The heterochronic parabiosis experiment. Right. So that was that idea took a long time in generating. Irene and I had discussed for years about aging and asking the question, why is it that when we age, all of our tissues seem to grow old together, right? There's different theories of aging. There's some that say it's some sort of program, and there's some that say, well, it's oxidative damage, or it might be UV rays or whatever, right? But all your tissues and all your cells seem to grow old together. You know, it doesn't matter whether the skin's on the outside and getting UV rays, or the gut's on the inside and getting, I don't know, junk food or something. Whether your muscle exercises or whether it doesn't exercise, it all seems to be some sort of coordination or some sort of systemic problem. So the idea we had was, well, what's in common to all the tissues? Well, there's the nervous system. Nerves endings extend almost everywhere. And then there's the blood that circulates throughout all the tissues. And of course, then the vasculature system that carries the blood and then the lymph. So the experiment that we had dreamed of was, what if we could do a blood transfusion between a young mouse and an old mouse? But at the time, we didn't think that was particularly possible because the blood vessels are so small. And it turns out later we found out that, yes, you can do that. But at the time, we didn't know that. And so we said, okay, well, that's a good experiment, a good idea, but we can't do it yet. So just kind of forget about it for now. So I forgot about it. Then Irina was giving a journal club presentation to the Rando lab, Tom Rando's lab at Stanford. And she was discussing a paper from Irv Weissman's lab. So Irv Weissman is the we call him the godfather of stem cell research. And Amy Wagers, one of the postdocs in his lab, who's now at Harvard famous, had done these experiments looking at bone marrow, so blood-generating stem cells, asking the question, do those cells ever traverse throughout the body and end up contributing to other tissues besides blood, right? And at the time, that was a important scientific question. And so the experiment she did was she took mice that were transgenic for green fluorescent protein, so all their cells fluoresce green, and she stitched them by parabiosis, which is kind of like a Siamese twinning, to a partner mouse where that was not transgenic, so all its cells are not green, and then asked, do the bone marrow cells end up in the other mouse, which they do, and then when they do that, they go through the circulation, do they end up in other tissues like the brain or the muscle or wherever? I mean, it turns out that they didn't really appreciably. So Irina's presenting this journal club paper to our lab, and you know, it's a big long table, and there's, you usually bring like potato chips and dip and, you know, maybe some coffee to drink or whatever. And I don't know why it's like, you know, every time there's, if I'm presenting a journal club, I can stay awake. But if I'm listening to another journal club or I'm at a seminar or whatever, I get to about the first 15 minutes and then that food hits or the coffee wears off, whatever. And I just fall asleep. So at the beginning, I was like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. They stitch mice together and then the skin grows back together and the blood vessels form and they can transfer blood from one animal to the other. You know, isn't that something amazing? Isn't that a thing? And then I, you know, kind of nod off. And then I came back awake realizing that was effectively a blood transfusion between two animals. And we could use that technique. And we had someone on campus who was an expert on that to answer the question of whether there was something in the blood that coordinated aging. So that was the genesis of that idea to do the...
Yeah, so then Mike basically said that the journal club, we need to do the same with young and old mice. And then I went to see Irv, who was my thesis committee member, so he knew me, and even though he is very famous, he took the meeting. And as soon as I said, Irv, we presented your parabiosis paper. What if instead of two young mice, we connect the young mouse and the old mouse? And I didn't even finish my sentence. And he already immediately nodded and said, great, go get discussions with Amy and she will teach you how to do this technique. So that's how this project started, which led to the 2005 Nature paper.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So how did the experiment turn out? What was the most important set of findings in your view?
So from our point of view, the most important set of findings were that you can very rapidly in just a couple of weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, rejuvenate all major organs in old mouse. And before that, of course, the prevalent theory was that aging is simple wear and tear, and so cells become old and you need new cells if you would like to rejuvenate. Mm-hmm. But these were old cells. They were very, very old. However, what we showed as one, I think the most important finding is that they had, for all practical purposes, the capacity to repair tissue almost, or for some tissues, just as well as young cells. So that was one key finding. The second finding, which was lurking in the background, was that there must be something bad in old blood because the young partners of old mice experienced noticeable decline in their ability to regenerate liver and brain, maintain brain and regenerate liver. And I think the third finding was linked to our science paper that showed that all of those biochemical signaling, which are typically important for stem cells to work in the first place, they are rejuvenated as well. So that gave us an idea of the mechanism. How does blood control our age? It doesn't control it somehow mysteriously. It most likely controls it by resetting key biochemistry to younger states. And that key biochemistry then tells the old stem cells to behave as if they're young. So I think those were the three key findings.
Yes, that 2005 paper in Nature that reported the results that we're discussing now, it generated an amazing amount of media attention and sparked a whole string of stories about things like vampires and how young people had better watch out for baby boomers, you know, how young blood holds the key to health and youth and other similar themes. Irina, I understand that you were frustrated and kind of surprised by the rather simplistic interpretations of your findings.
Absolutely, yes. So in fact, at the time we were giving a bunch of talks on the topic and Mike even suggested to borrow somebody's little kid and put him or her in the backpack and then wear the backpack in my bag during the presentation as if my blood is being transfused with the young blood.
I like that.
Just give him, you know, exactly. We never did it really, you know, give them like a laser pointer to play with and then just go through your talk. So we never did it. But really, what I mentioned earlier was really frustrating to me. It was really like a caricature on our discoveries, is that the origin of the discovery or the key point of the discovery was to see that the aging is plastic that could be reversed and see how it can be reversed mechanistically. It was not to jump to this simplistic conclusion that young blood itself is a medicine, which I was always argued against since our paper.
So although the old mouse seemed to become younger in many aspects, it was unclear exactly what the mechanism was behind this transformation. And as a result, a lot of different people focus on the idea that young blood infused into an older animal might reverse aging. But you two went a different direction, and instead of looking for a magic pro-youthful component to be found in young blood, you reasoned that it would make more sense to look for something in the old blood that suppressed growth. That is, the young mouse might be filtering some inhibitory compound from the blood of the old mouse. So Michael, can you elaborate on this and tell us about the search that identified the inhibitory compound, which turned out to be transforming growth factor beta 1 or TGF beta 1.
Sure. TGF beta 1 is an inhibitory compound, and there are probably others. There certainly are others that we know of that are also inhibitory. So the search from that came from some experiments that we did. One experiment I'm looking around for, and I'm not so sure that we actually ever published this, but it's a pretty simple experiment to do. So most any scientist could do it. If you take your favorite cells and they're growing in culture, favorite stem progenitor cells, they usually need to grow in some sort of cell culture medium, because, you know, salts and vitamins and sugar and amino acids and stuff. And they need serum. It's the liquid fraction of clotted blood. If you grow them in serum from a young animal, they grow very well. If you grow them in serum from an old animal, they usually grow much, much worse. So that's sort of like an in vitro or, you know, in the tissue culture dish model for aging, right? It's the signaling pathways that these cells are using are the same ones that we find in tissues in vivo. And so when I did the experiment, I grew cells in young serum and grew cells in old serum and then mixed the two serum together and asked which one would win. And it looked like the old serum was winning. So the cells grew poorly, even though they had young serum in their culture, but they also had the old serum, which seemed to be suppressing the growth of and anything good in the young serum, the growth of the cells and anything good in the young serum. So that got us on the search for what is it in the old serum. So Irina has a great mind for this. So she knows all these signaling pathways and she knows all the players in the signaling pathways. They're like her friends, right? There's different ways of figuring out something. So you can get on a computer and you can compute it and do something in silico. Irina's approach was what I call in biblio. So she sat in front of on the computer and got onto PubMed and made a short list of compounds that circulate in the blood that probably increase with age, that are probably part of a family, so that there's not just one signaling molecule. If it's only one signaling molecule that's encoded by one gene, then you'd probably have a mutant someplace that had a mutation in that one signal, and then you'd know that those mutants would either live longer or live shorter or, you know, have better regeneration or not, right? So it probably was something that had many family members, right? So that one mutation in one really wouldn't affect anything.
Suppresses proliferation.
You wanted something that suppresses proliferation, right?
Increases inflammation and fibrosis.
Right, increases inflammation and fibrosis. I think of it as sort of as being pro-differentiation and less for growth. So she made a short list of, maybe 12 things. And we systematically tested them in the lab. You can get these biochemicals from the biochemical catalog and they come fresh on ice. And you can take a few microliters and put it in your cell culture and see, does it inhibit the growth of your favorite stem cells? And so we did that on a number of signaling molecules and TGF-beta family came up as being potent. So then the next questions, of course, is it really elevated in the blood? And is the TGF-beta signaling more as we get old? And can you, through the circulation, through the blood, modulate TGF-beta signaling? So that was the start of a whole series of papers and a couple few years of investigation in Irina's lab here at Cal at Berkeley.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
In 2016, you two published a really interesting paper in Nature Communications in which you described a new, more definitive experiment than the parabiosis experiment earlier, aimed at distinguishing between whether it is, in fact, the young blood that is having the beneficial effects on the old mice, or whether the positive effects are caused by the removal of inhibitors, as we were just discussing, in the old blood. In comparison to the early work, this new experiment was much more complex to conduct, I imagine, as it was really a blood exchange experiment in which only the blood is exchanged between the two animals. Irina, can you describe this experiment and what were the primary outcomes?
Of course. For a while, it was also bothering me that people interpret results of parabiosis, which is a skin suturing when animals run around together for several weeks, as blood transfusion. And in parabiosis, of course, many things will be changed, and the most important one is organ sharing. For example, old mice now have young sets of kidneys, young liver, young heart and lungs, and so many simple things like blood oxygenation or simple metabolism conducted by liver will be also improved. So it doesn't have to work through blood. Additionally, old mice have environmental enrichment because they are connected to young partners. So they're running around the cage and they regularly go to drink and eat. And if they're not connected, they just sit in the corner of the cage and shiver. Right. So many things in their environment and simple diet and exercise also change. So it really boggled my mind as to why people would just say that all of these different and variable effects are just through the secret sauce in blood. So to overcome this ambiguity in experimental system, what we did, we developed the blood transfusion, which was developed with the big help with respect to support from Sense Foundation. And they also gave us advice on the people who could help us with that. For example, this very talented MD, postdoc, Justin Rebo, who now is the chief scientific officer of the BioAge startup. So he was in our laboratory and he got it going. So what he did, he showed us that we can cannulate these tiny, tiny mouse veins and we can have the computer-operated device which will exchange known amounts of blood and blood only between young and old animals. And after that, they are not connected to each other. They basically wake up from this very humanely done surgery under general anesthesia, which is also much less invasive than parabiosis. And they go their separate ways in their separate cages, and they're just being the young and old mice. So that was much better controlled system, which allowed us to critically answer the question, what is dominant? Is it the young blood and can it work as a medicine? Or is it the old blood with its inhibitors dominant and we need to remove it? And very interestingly, for all of the organs that we tested, and particularly for the brain, it was the old blood that dominantly blocked neurogenesis and in fact prevented some cognitive and agility skills in young mice. So even though young mice had 50% of their own young blood still, but having 50% of old blood immediately aged them with respect to the brain. And very interestingly, we had exactly the same conclusion from our early parabiosis studies, even though the brain work was not published in 2005 paper with liver and muscle, but it was identical. We had these findings which were reviewed by Nature, but never made it into the final paper, that in a young animal that is parabios to the old animal, ability to form new neurons or new brain cells is declined by 50%. So we shared these studies, the findings before they were published with Professor Tony Weiss-Corey, and then his laboratory went on to reproduce them and publish them in 2011 Nature. And then they decided to pursue more behavioral aspects of the brain aging and rejuvenation, which is all over, you know, it's great for the field to have numerous laboratories to work on this issue.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating experiment. And it certainly seems that it relatively decisively pins down that the negative effect of old blood is indeed much greater than the beneficial effects of young blood. Even if young blood does have some benefit, it would seem overwhelmed in this case by the negative effects of old blood.
Exactly. That's exactly our conclusion, is that, of course, there are good molecules in young blood. The question is, what is the concentration? How much of this you need to have to offset this really bad dominant effect of the old blood?
Those experiments came at a time when our lab had trouble getting funding, right? And it was for a bunch of reasons, one of which is just sort of random chance. We had published some good papers on the TGF-beta, but, you know, whatever, funding was just drying up then. And we were discussing with Aubrey de Grey, who runs the SENS Foundation, so S-E-N-S, Strategies for Engineering Negligible Senescence. And if you've ever seen Aubrey de Grey, he's a character. He's kind of like Gandalf, when Gandalf was younger, kind of looking guy. Brilliant guy.
And Professor Dumbledore.
Whatever, right?
If Dumbledore was thinner.
and a lot younger. Anyway, so we were discussing, sort of like how Irene and I were originally discussing the idea of, is there something in the circulation that controls aging? We were discussing in the parabiosis experiment, just the questions you brought up, is it because of the blood circulation or is it because of the sharing of the organs and systems that you get when you're connected constantly, sharing blood constantly with a partner? And so we discussed the idea of doing transfusions and our lament that we didn't have the technical expertise to do vascular surgery on something as tiny as a mouse blood vessel. And he knew someone who could do the vascular surgery on the mouse blood vessel. So I really have to thank Aubrey and the SENS Foundation for helping us do that work, for finding Justin Rebo and getting us in contact together, and for funding that work, especially at a time when we didn't have other funds to do that. Those experiments.
And also, before moving on, I would like to interject and to clarify that one of the reasons that the funding dried up was that our personal struggles, that I am a breast cancer survivor. And at the time, I did have all of the the horrible things which happens to a person when they have breast cancer, including very tough chemotherapy, mastectomy, and radiation. And of course, after that, I was not really in the same level of energy or mood to keep writing grant proposals all the time. So Aubrey and other people in the field knew about it, and they responded in the best possible way. They basically brainstormed scientific ideas that they felt they could fund, and that eventually, a few years down the road, when, knock on wood, I'm now cancer-free for over 8 years, not only helped us to get healthy in our brain, but also materialized into this interesting paper.
Great story, and what a fortunate meeting when you two met Aubrey de Grey.
So Ambrosia, which is a startup company that's here in Florida, claims that it can combat aging by infusing blood plasma from young people into its customers. And the company is selling this young blood for $8,000 a liter. I've read some articles where you've been quite critical of Ambrosia. Can you talk about your concerns?
Yeah, so we heard about Ambrosia. The story was that they were in the Bay Area, maybe in Monterey, and then maybe in the Peninsula area, that someone was setting up a company or a service to infuse people with blood plasma from young donors, and they were selling it for, again, $8,000 an infusion. I forget what the volume is there, too, like a liter or a couple liters. And that was surprising at the time, again, because we had always thought of the parabiosis papers and other people who had published parabiosis and heterochronic parabiosis work since that time, that it was not clear that there was something particular in the young blood that was rejuvenative that it could also be, and in our data showed that it was probably more likely something that was in the old blood that was suppressive. So there was a few things about that story that troubled me. One was that it was a fee for service kind of thing on something that was untested. Blood is kind of unregulated by the FDA. Although I understand recently they came out with a statement about that kind of therapy. So it seemed like an easy way for someone to provide something and get rich off of a service without actually having it show that it actually does anything good. And I wasn't convinced from the early stories that they were actually going to do any kind of clinical trial and document or investigate whether the treatment was actually doing anything good or not. Since then, I haven't seen any data that was published on the effects of giving a liter or so of young plasma to people. So scientifically, it was questionable.
Yeah, I read somewhere that they were planning to do some sort of a trial, I think, funded by these initial set of recipients. But this whole discussion raises an interesting question of whether young people should store blood during their youth and preserve it for infusing later. Even given what we've just been discussing, has anyone ever taken the blood, for example, of youthful mice, allowed the mice to age, and then reinfused this blood into the same mice to determine if the animal's blood could induce a youthful phenotype in some way or to some extent? Has anyone ever looked at that?
This is not necessary because in mice, we have inbred mouse strains. So it is as if you always have your youthful twin, identical twin.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that you are now 70 years old, but there are also plenty of you who are only 20 years old. So we don't need to store the blood. We could just take very fresh young blood of a young mouse and put it in an old mouse, which we did.
Mm.
And even if you do it 50%, right, then there is no improvement really. There is some improvement.
Well, for muscle and liver.
For muscle and liver, there is no improvement for the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And this is fresh blood.
And we're removing half the old blood.
And we are removing half of the old blood.
A lot of
that
blood.
That is also important. So if you think about the moving forward, there are so much more elegant and effective ways than store your own blood, not knowing what is going to happen to it over the next 50 years, and then sit in the infusion chair and have this procedure done to you with potential dangers of that blood got contaminated or infected or is no longer functional.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to add for the Ambrosia part is that it was never clear to me what exactly they are putting into people. Where do they get blood? Is it blood or plasma? Does it come from homeless people who donate blood? That is unfortunate, maybe a phenomenon of our society. Is it pathogen-free? And if it is pathogen-free, one conventional way to make it pathogen-free would also kill all of the youthful proteins in blood. So is it then effective? So without all of these details, which would come out in the peer review publication, it's very difficult for me to say that there is anything beneficial in the fluids that people are paying a lot to be put in them.
Mm. I know they had filed on the FDA site that they were going to do a clinical trial, but if you were going to do a clinical trial, you would do a pilot, let's say in the California, in the Bay Area. You'd get the data that from that and you would publish it and say, well, it's safe and or maybe effective before you opened up clinics all around the country. And my understanding that they went and opened up clinics in New York or in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
That to me seems more like a business model, not a scientific mm-hmm. clinical trial.
Yeah.
And also there are a bunch of reviews, sorry to interrupt, there are a bunch of review papers from people who do blood transfusions for really life-saving reasons. For example, somebody lost lots of blood and they need blood transfusion. And those reviews mention numerous horrible side effects of blood transfusion. So, of course, infection with viruses or other pathogens in blood is only one of them. But the worst one is activating your immune system. So you pretty much have graft versus host or host versus graft, where transfused blood effectively attacks mm-hmm. your own body. Mm-hmm. And that can cause, you know, not just allergies, but anaphylactic shock and lung collapse. And we have heard some rumors that in fact, could happen from this regenerative transfusion.
Autoimmune disease.
Autoimmune
months
disease.
Later, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then months or even years later, you can develop incurable multiple sclerosis or other autoimmune diseases because you inappropriately triggered your immune system by this procedure. As I mentioned, in laboratory, we have mice that are genetically identical to each other. Some are young and some are old. For people, that is not the case, right? So you just get somebody else's bodily fluids, which are different from yours in the composition of many proteins, and you're basically injecting them. I think basically my summary is that the study should be more regulated, or this whole approach should be more regulated to know that we do no harm.
So if it's the age of a stem cell's environment that is the key, do you think your research and findings are going to discourage the use of cell-based therapies to treat disorders that are related to aging?
That is one thing that we used to say in our scientific presentations and review papers is that we cannot assume that if you make brand new cells, be they cells neuron or retinal cells or muscle cells, and put them in an old individual, people will get better because the cells which we are putting in now will find themselves in the environment of chronic inflammation, fibrosis, and biochemical dysregulation. So they, in my opinion, might quickly perish, just like the original cells did, unless we provide them with a protective layer of biomaterial, which will allow them to survive in this horrible old body environment. So it is not that we should stop cell transplantation. We should just be more clever about how we conduct it.
Yeah. So can you share with us how you and your colleagues in the bioengineering department at Southern Cal are developing youthful micro-niches for cell and tissue transplantation?
So our colleagues are not really at Southern Cal. They are at Keck Graduate Institute. And this is a brilliant former postdoc who now starting her own laboratory, an engineer, Dr. Kiana Aran. So we have numerous ideas. I cannot really share with you, not simply because it's a secret. It is not really a secret at this point. It's just simply in the very early stages of development. But we are not focusing per se on cell transplantation. What we are working on is developing the new blood transfusion devices and exchange fluids where you don't have to get anybody else's bodily fluids. When what happens if you have your own blood and it goes through the clever device where we remove all of the age-elevated bad molecules, normalizing their levels to those of the young circulation, and we add whatever is missing, and then you get back your own blood, but now it is molecularly rejuvenated. And so we believe that that will be much safer. And because the procedure itself is already FDA approved for other diseases, we could then test our devices in mice and then scale them up and perhaps allow for their use in people. So that is mm-hmm. kind of one of the ideas that is a little bit more developed.
It's interesting. In 2014, your group published a paper in Nature Communications showing that in mice, oxytocin is necessary for muscle maintenance and regeneration, and that the lack of oxytocin leads to premature sarcopenia. Old mice that were given subcutaneous injections of oxytocin improved muscle regeneration to an amazing degree, In the images, it looked almost like young muscle. Further, as noted by one of your co-authors, Wendy Cousins, and this is a quote, extra oxytocin boosts aged tissue stem cells without making muscle stem cells divide uncontrollably. Irina, can you talk about this fascinating study and its possible implications in humans?
So again, we are not saying that there is nothing good in a young mouse or young human that we lose with age. There definitely are numerous molecules. And so oxytocin is this juvenile hormone, is one of them. So oxytocin is known as a love and trust hormone. And it also what makes us think that little kitties and doggies are so cute. They're so cute. And they're so cute is because when we look at them, we start producing oxytocin, and that makes us love them. So that's how oxytocin was described before. It is a molecule which has been known for at least 90 years, but it was mostly known with respect to giving birth and then lactation and bond between mother and a child. So then what we discovered is that oxytocin that does not just have effects on the brain and how we perceive each other, but it also critically important for us being healthy, for having healthy muscle and healthy bone and even healthy metabolism. And with age, oxytocin declines. So if you add it back, you then increase muscle maintenance and repair, so it becomes younger. So that was the discovery which we made in that paper. Mm. And also understanding of human aging is that it has been known for a while that if old people live in a loving family or they have friends, they are in the better health as compared to lonely old people. And so oxytocin will increase every time that somebody tells you that, oh, you are such a good person, or gives you a hug. And so perhaps a lot of this, what we noticed about society and how people are healthier when they live together in old age, some of that maybe relates to oxytocin levels.
So in the media piece associated with the article, Wendy Cousins noted that oxytocin could become a viable alternative to hormone replacement therapy as a way to combat the symptoms of both female and male aging, and also for long-term health. Could you elaborate a little bit on that possibility?
Well, oxytocin is downstream of estrogen, and estrogen could be used as the hormone replacement therapy, but perhaps there are some side effects. And so being downstream of estrogen, oxytocin is more specific to maintenance of muscle and bone, and perhaps it can offset then osteoporosis and muscle wasting. And by the way, it is also FDA approved, right? So I would suggest that it is a better, much safer alternative to go through maybe pilot clinical trials and then look into off-label use of oxytocin as compared to somebody else's undefined bodily fluid mm-hmm. that Ambrosia is doing.
That work on oxytocin was published. Wendy Cousin is a first author on that paper. Her husband, Christian Aloud, is also co-first author on that paper. And Wendy and Christian, they've been working together since postdoc, kind of like us.
They had the
first Convoy Lab baby, right? And now they're back in the Bay Area, as I understand it, and they're working for a startup, anti-aging startup called Spring.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're talking about the off-label use for intranasal oxytocin. It's now widely used off-label for a wide range of ailments. And although there have been some human trials of oxytocin associated with mental disorders such as autism, schizophrenia, and dementia, it would seem appropriate to have human trials aimed at the potential for oxytocin to prevent, slow, or ameliorate some of the undesirable consequences of aging, as we've been talking about. Do you know of any studies that are underway looking at oxytocin explicitly in the context of aging in humans?
No, we don't. And in this regard, I would like to plug in our recently issued U.S. patent. So it was issued a couple of weeks ago. And it is specifically on a combination of oxytocin with inhibitor of TGF-beta-1 called ALK5 inhibitor. Again, as we mentioned a couple of times, we don't think that one single molecule will be effective enough if you try to use it long term to really offset various phenotypes of aging. However, we now believe that if you combine both of our discovery tracks, such as oxytocin and TGF-beta attenuation, you might be successful. So we are fully committed to testing it in clinical trials. If there are any dedicated funding, I think that will be really, really good to do because both of them, oxytocin and ALK5 inhibitors, are FDA approved for various illnesses. So we know that they are safe in a particular range of concentrations. And there are other numerous parameters that have been already tested and found to be safe. So absolutely, we are in fact looking into performing these clinical studies.
In your muscle paper dealing with oxytocin, it was injected in subcutaneous fat. And the off-label uses that one sees now, pretty widespread, are using intranasal oxytocin typically. In your view, would one expect to see any muscle effects from intranasal oxytocin, or would the level not be high enough at the muscle itself?
I'm not such an expert on the administration of oxytocin. Probably an MD person would know more about that. But it's my general understanding that it doesn't really matter how you get the oxytocin in your body, mm-hmm. as far as how much of it ends up in the blood. I understand that if you administer oxytocin intranasally, there's might be a better chance of getting some to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
That's why people administer that way. Whereas something, let's say, like orally eating oxytocin maybe gives you the least amount that ends up in your brain. But yeah, I would imagine even intranasal oxytocin, if it gets in the blood, then it gets to the muscle. And then if your muscle is trying to regenerate itself, that will give a boost to the stem cells.
Yeah, it seems interesting if, you know, people have looked at the blood levels that you get with intranasal oxytocin, but mm-hmm. I don't know what blood level would be necessary to see the effect that you described.
Well, that's part of the studies that we're doing now, and part of this patent that Irina mentioned was by combining a positive signal or multiple positive signals with inhibiting a negative signal or several negative signals, and negative meaning something that's pro-aging, right?
Mm-hmm.
So negative for regeneration. By inhibiting that and adding something positive, you can use a lot lower dose.
And a lot shorter.
And shorter administration of any of these compounds, because the drugs are acting in a synergistic way,
right,
on the local stem cells.
And I just want to add that it's very, very important, because we test, for example, oxytocin in mice in a very short time frame, just less than 2 weeks.
Mm.
And if you think about human applications, you want it to be a routine and you want it to be repetitive.
Right.
And you cannot really, I think, work on one angle or use only one molecule to offset all of the deleterious effects of aging and not to skew this important biochemical signal. So now, instead of positive effect, you have disease.
Mm.
Because we cannot just keep adding the same drug over and over again. You will hyperactivate MAP kinase signaling, and that will induce more problems than benefits. However, if you now use several angles, then, or several different molecules, some are activating, another are inhibiting, then each one is a really mild suggestion to biochemistry instead of overpowering biochemistry. And this way, we believe that you can offset aging long term.
Interestingly, you found that administration of oxytocin promoted stem cell activation and proliferation and muscle regeneration in aged mice by activating the MAPK-ERK signaling pathway. And this is the same signaling pathway that one sees activated by the fasting metabolite acetoacetate in skeletal muscle. And folks have reported that it was sufficient to induce myogenesis. Michael, perhaps there is more than one way, as Irina was just saying, sort of a multifaceted approach to skinning the aging cat. Any thoughts on that?
Well, certainly, I think there's multiple ways of approaching aging, and there's probably a lot of reason to think that combinatorial approaches would be the best. Specifically on acetoacetate, right? So acetoacetate, I had to look this up. It's one of the two main ketones that you get from burning fatty acids, right? So you get a long chain fatty acid, and then you break it down metabolically into just 2-carbon acetate, and that acetate feeds into the Krebs cycle or the TCA cycle or the oxidative phosphorylation cycle that our cells use to generate potentially most of their energy, sort of aerobic respiration. So I looked up this paper. It's just one paper that seems to show that this acetoacetate will induce the MAP kinase signaling and induce myogenesis. It's published in JBC, Journal of Biological Chemistry, an excellent journal. Seems like a good paper. It's definitely suggestive that there might be something more than just metabolism going on with this,
right,
small molecule. So that's interesting. I don't know if I want to go into the details of the paper, but the model that they were using to show that it was activating the myogenic cells was that they would starve these myogenic stem progenitor cells from their serum for half a day before adding the acetate.
Mm-hmm.
Just technically, as I'm reading that, I'm wondering, are the cells cells would normally respond to serum starvation by stopping their division, by stopping their cell cycles, and by attempting to differentiate. And these muscle cells, what they do is they fuse and they form little muscle tubes, little muscle fibers in the petri dish. So I have to ask, in this model, if the cells are being starved and being pushed to differentiate, and you add this acetoacetate, and it activates MAP kinase, and it causes the cells to continue to proliferate, is it activating the MAP kinase and causing them to proliferate, or is it inhibiting them from their response to the serum withdrawal and stopping them from differentiating, in which case you just end up with having more cells that are proliferating in the culture? Anyway, super interesting. I hope to read more papers on that in the future. Maybe the bigger discussion is on the idea of fasting and aging and ketogenic diets and aging and metabolism and aging, which is, there's a lot of publications on that.
That's a lot
more accepted in the aging field, that there's definitely something to having cells use their biochemistry and to cycle into not burning sugars and to burn fats periodically, whether it's from fasting or whether it's from a particular diet or a dietary compound.
Right. In recent years, most of the research excitement around both acetoacetate and beta-hydroxybutyrate have focused not so much on their metabolic effects, which are pretty well understood, but on their signaling effects. And it's like monthly people are publishing papers on signaling effects, both as an HDAC inhibitor, as well as the kind of effect that we're discussing here. And I think that's pretty interesting and sort of still early days.
Right. They would signal, not in the same way that Irina was talking about signal transduction molecules, where you have a signal and a receptor. These would be signaling sort of like in the inner workings of the battery of this that drives all the cells, right?
Well, more broadly
in the biochemical pathways.
Yeah. A group working at MIT in Susan Erdman's lab has reported lots of benefits in mice fed Lactobacillus reuteri, which has been found to upregulate oxytocin significantly. Germane to our discussion, they reported the L. reuteri counteracts age-associated sarcopenia. Have you seen their work, and have you tracked that, and can you talk about that if so?
Sure. So we followed that work a little. It's very interesting, and I've read that other groups have reproduced many of the findings, which is always a good thing to see in science. It kind of reminds me of that, I don't know, if you're around in the 70s and 80s, they used to have these old Danon commercials that featured some Georgians eating yogurt and living to a long time. And Georgians meaning not state of Georgia, but old Soviet Georgia, right? So
the
country in the Caucasus, someplace where people live at high altitude and farm sheep or something like that. And I wonder about the microbes. Is it any gut microbe, or if it's something specific with Lactobacillus? Although I just read that they did a study where they had bacterial lysate, so they weren't live bacillus. They just made an extract out of it. And there's something that floats around that the Lactobacillus produces that stimulates the oxytocin production in animals and in people, which I guess it maybe isn't super surprising if you imagine that you're a Lactobacillus and you're swimming or you're tumbling, and pretty much all you really want to do as a bacterium is find food. So oxytocin stimulates lactation. So if you're a bacterium and you live off of milk, Lactobacillus, and you can get your mammal host to lactate, then you basically provide yourself with more food environment.
Yeah,
so I thought that was kind of an interesting possibility, right?
Yeah, that goes to this idea that really we are controlled in our behavior by small things like bacteria that makes us to grow yeast and make beer and lactate and make them substrates, and whatever is in our gut really controls what we do in our mind. So that is kind of this off-track theory.
Yeah, they were particularly focused on Lactobacillus reuteri, and I think they were using a product from Sweden, if I'm remembering right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that will be a good paper to maybe discuss in our journal club in the future and recommend. It's very flattering for us when what we discover is not simply confirmed by our labs, but is taken forward, is extrapolated in their own experimental systems. So if you show that oxytocin combats sarcopenia and they show that Lactobacillus combats sarcopenia through oxytocin, that's great. That's very good news.
Yeah, I think so too.
So the two of you and a team of colleagues, mostly at UC Berkeley, including Niren Murthy in the bioengineering department, published a 2017 study in Nature Biomedical Engineering, which demonstrated a novel approach called CRISPR-Gold that corrected the Duchenne muscular dystrophy mutation in mice without the use of viruses. Irina, can you talk about this exciting work and also its implications?
Yes, so that is indeed exciting work because CRISPR by itself did not really evolve to be therapeutic. It evolved to cut DNA, double-stranded DNA, and make double-stranded DNA breaks, which actually is not good if you think about it. It's horrible. It's the worst type of DNA mutation. So the tricks of making CRISPR treat diseases is not just by using this enzyme, but by deciding on how you are going to use it intelligently. And so if you are using viruses and you introduce gene encoding this enzyme into patient cells, then you will have accumulation of DNA damage with time. And that is horrible because such cells which accumulated DNA damage, they will either die or they can turn into cancers. So therefore, with Niren Murthy's laboratory, we designed a delivery vehicle for CRISPR-Cas9 that will work only transiently, repair DNA and correct mutations, and then it will disappear. So there is no danger of DNA damage accumulation. And so they designed the nanoparticles with the gold core, and then Mike Conboy then coined this term CRISPR gold, like the best CRISPR ever.
But literally my only contribution to the work.
No, it is not. And then CRISPR-Cas9 is presented as a protein, not as the DNA encoded in the virus. And there is also a guide RNA part and donor DNA template part. So it's like a working machinery or the factory which has all of the parts that you need. So it has the enzyme, it has the template, healthy template from which to repair your DNA, and it has a guide RNA. So then they're all put onto the nanoparticle, and nanoparticles are injected into muscle. They work not just to turn Duchenne muscular dystrophy mutation into milder mutation, as previously published, but to actually correct Duchenne muscular dystrophy disease into the wild-type genetic sequence. So now you have cure. Mm. And so that was the big, I think, big impact of this paper, is that it is safer, it is more effective, and it is actually is not turning one disease into a milder disease. It produces potential cure.
Yeah, it was a very exciting paper.
Yeah.
If you both were given unlimited resources to answer any scientific question, what question would you attempt to answer, and how would you proceed if funding wasn't an issue, and it almost always is?
Well, some of the outstanding questions that we have from the work that we've done so far and others have done is, I would want to know if the mice that we rejuvenate, do they live longer and healthier longer? A lot of the studies that we've done look at a fairly short-term rejuvenation of whatever tissue, muscle, liver, brain, from some sort of intervention. But we don't know yet if that how long that lasts, and does that translate into a longer health span for the mice, and something that we could translate then into humans. So that's definitely high on the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the project that I'm trying to fund, and if I had unlimited funding, I would do is that it relates to this idea that, not idea, in fact, fact, that we do not age identically to each other, even though there might be some common elements of aging in all of us. But in my opinion, it is difficult to offset aging if you have the same drug for everybody. So understanding the person-specific features of aging through a bunch of omics, which we started in the laboratory, and then finding FDA-approved ways to make that person younger. Mm-hmm. So kind of personalized precision rejuvenation is something that I would do. And in related topic, we have a few developments in the laboratory that are ready for the off-label clinical trials or studies. So that is another thing that we would do, because there are numerous devastating diseases of aging. For example, Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, dementias. And we believe that we have rational strategies of improving the situation for people. But to do that, we really need to do clinical studies first and to be very careful. And that's what I would do.
Fantastic.
Irina, I hear you have a bumper sticker on your office that says, "Don't believe everything you think." Actually, I would like to get one of those bumper stickers, but I'm curious. What do you tell the students when they ask you about that bumper sticker?
So it's kind of the bumper sticker that speaks for itself, and that's why it is on my office. because when students come to have scientific meetings with Mike and me, I want them to see that. They do not really ask much about it because it's self-explanatory, is that we might have particular ideas, we have many of them. But if we start pushing our data towards confirming the idea, we are in trouble. So that is the point. Do not believe everything you think. You might think that this is how it works, but as a good detective, you need to collect the data first and then follow where the data leads you. So that is the point of the sticker. And then Mike had some advice for you where to find bumper stickers.
Right. So Telegraph Ave in Berkeley is where you find this, the sidewalk vendors that have their tables and all sorts of bumper stickers or t-shirts. although that particular sticker, it says in fine print, it's from Northern Sun Merchandising out of Minnesota. So you can go on the Northern Sun Merchandising website and get a whole bunch of stickers if you want.
I was going to ask. I'm glad you guys clarified that. So the two of you have been married for more than 25 years, and you don't have any children. But I understand if someone were to drop by your house during the day, they quite likely would hear Sesame Street playing. So why do you have a fondness for Sesame Street?
So the parrots, we had two parrots, a yellow nape, so kind of a green parrot, and then a big blue and gold macaw, which kind of looks like the parrot blue. On that cartoon Rio, but we've since gotten rid of the parrots, or I should say we rehomed the parrots because they just really weren't getting enough attention. We were spending too much time in lab and not enough time at home. And they're very social, and they need to be constantly part of a flock and be carrying on and causing trouble as a group socially all day long. So the Sesame Street was during the day we would leave them in their parrot room, and they would just get super bored. So I found a little TV and was able to plug it in for them and watch some sort of over the air shows. And Sesame Street was the show that they would screech the least at. So I guess it's because they have all the Muppets in there, and then they kind of, some of those characters look kind of like, it was Big Bird, right? Looks like a bird. And it's simple things that you know, a parrot can relate to, like, you know, food, simple counting, you know, good and bad, that kind of thing, right? So they used to love that show.
That's
fantastic. That's a great story.
So we don't have any parrots, but I've been we have chickens now, and I've been trying to teach. There's a pair of ravens that live on the hill behind our house, and I've been trying to train the ravens to babysit the chickens when we're gone during the day.
You have to incentivize
hard-boiled
them.
Eggs. So I've convinced them that the eggs are the chickens are laying eggs, and then I give them a daily hard-boiled egg. So they have interest in keeping those chickens alive. Produce more eggs.
Now they'll come eat all the
eat
eggs.
Eat all the eggs. Yeah.
Ravens are phenomenally smart.
Yes. So, Michael and Irina, this has been fantastic having you all on STEM Talk. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the interest to our science.
Yeah,
it's very
you.
Important for us. Thank
yeah.
you.
Oh, it's super interesting, the work you folks do.
Absolutely.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
So, I have to say, I don't even know where to begin. Irina and Michael have such a fascinating story. I love, first of all, how they came together and then how they ended up working together. And obviously, their research that they're doing does indeed have profound implications for the future of aging.
Absolutely. And not just aging, but all the associated chronic and degenerative diseases that one associates with aging, including Parkinson's and osteoporosis, sarcopenia. Their work is of potential broad importance. And they gave us some pretty rich insights into potential biomedical solutions that may one day help with degenerative and metabolic diseases of aging.
If you enjoyed this interview as much as Ken and I did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage, where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others, so please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.